Welcome to the Liberation Pedagogy Podcast. This is a place where radical ideas and methods are discussed in the quest towards freedom making. It is a space to dialogue, share, and learn about revolutionary politics, political struggles, radical solidarities, cultural resistance, healing justice, and is a crossing to unearth legacies of resistance pedagogies, global radicalism, and internationalism. I'm your host, Chani Desai, and if you like this episode, please subscribe. Hi, everybody. In this episode of the Liberation Pedagogy Podcast, we will be speaking about Kashmir. And today our guest is Hafsa Kanjwal. Hafsa Kanjwal is an assistant professor who teaches South Asian history at Lafayette College. She received her PhD from the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor in History and Women's Studies. Her research focuses on post-partition state building in Indian-occupied Kashmir. She has also written and spoken on Kashmir for a variety of news outlets, including the Washington Post, Al Jazeera English, and the BBC, just to name a few. Thank you, Hafsa, for being here today and taking the time for this really, really important conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.
Before we delve into our conversation today, I just want to provide listeners with a brief context of what we will be discussing. So Kashmir has been disputed between India and Pakistan for the past 72 years and awaits a resolution. Yet the rule of the former India has been met with massive resistance by Kashmiris for decades, even well before 1947. And it has now been over 1 year since India's right-wing Hindutva ruling party, the Bharatiya Janata Party, the BJP, stripped Kashmir of its last vestiges of autonomy and placed the territory under a long military siege, putting 8 million Kashmiris under curfew, detaining thousands, and imposing an unprecedented communication lockdown. Kashmir was already one of the most highly militarized regions of conflict in the world. Yet this militarism has intensified since August 2019 because the fascist BJP government wants to accelerate the complete annexation of the portion of Kashmir occupied by India. By initiating the abrogation of Article 370 of the Indian Constitution, which initially enshrined some degree of Kashmiri autonomy to the Kashmiri people, was gutted last year, and a bill was moved proposing that Jammu and Kashmir be divided into two union territories directly ruled by New Delhi. Additionally, Article 35A, which permits the local legislature the parameters to define permanent residency in Kashmir, and also forbids outsiders from settling the land, buying land, holding jobs or educational scholarships, was repealed, and a shift towards domicile status, which removes important legal protections for Kashmiris, was imposed as a policy that also attempts demographic change of the majority Muslim region. This siege and lockdown has also resulted in an economic loss of more than $5.3 billion and will lead to the further exploitation of land and resources by capitalists and the further dispossession of Kashmiris. These moves continue to undermine Kashmiri sovereignty, repress resistance, and silence dissent, which has led to a global outcry against the Indian state's moves. And the current COVID-19 pandemic has further exacerbated life under occupation. And so, Hafsa, can you begin by providing a brief historical context of the conflict and occupation of Kashmir, as well as provide or give us some insight on the historical penning of these articles in the Indian Constitution?
Yeah, sure. Thank you so much for such a great introduction. So, you know, many people, when they think about Kashmir, they usually frame it as simply a territorial dispute between India and Pakistan. But what kind of a new generation of Kashmir scholars are really attempting to do is move beyond that simplistic framing. So just referring to the Indian occupation of Kashmir in particular, that began at the time of the partition of the Indian subcontinent. So for those listeners who are familiar, when the British colonial rule left the Indian subcontinent, It did so, as in many other places, in leaving the region in a mess. Partition happened, and the region was divided into Muslim majority Pakistan and India, which maintained a Hindu majority, although it also had significant Muslim population as well. So Kashmir was, at that time, the state of Jammu and Kashmir was a princely state, which was ruled by a princely ruler under the Dogra dynasty. And it was a Muslim majority region comprised of the regions of the Kashmir Valley, which is sort of where the resistance to Indian rule is the strongest. Ladakh, which has both Muslim and Buddhist population, and also Jammu, which today actually has a Hindu majority, but at that time had a Muslim majority. And the Dogra ruler at the time was extremely repressive towards Kashmir's Muslim population in particular, mm-hmm. And had essentially in many ways kind of fell out of any kind of legitimacy to be able to make this decision on whether Kashmir would join India and Pakistan. Mm-hmm. And there was a massive uprising against his rule, starting in Jammu, but also in the valley as well, against the monarchy. And he repressed it quite heavily. So this demographic change that we are speaking about today actually has a precedence in Kashmiri history in 1947 and 1948. Mm. But be that as it may, basically, India and Pakistan went to war over Kashmir. And India took the issue to the United Nations, and the UN basically called for a cessation of hostilities, a ceasefire, demilitarization of both Indian troops, but as well as Pakistani troops and a group of kind of these tribes that had come in and were trying to liberate Kashmir from India. And they'd also called for a plebiscite. And that is essentially the crux of this conflict 7 decades on, is that plebiscite hasn't taken place. Pakistan's official position is that it supports the right to self-determination of Kashmiris. However, India says that because that Maharaja acceded to the Indian Union, India has complete kind of legal claims over Kashmir. And, you know, after 1947, India basically kind of undermined the call for a plebiscite by incorporating Kashmir into the Indian nation state. So keeping that in mind, that context in mind, India installed a series of client regimes in Kashmir. Mm. And the first of these regimes had been promised some level of autonomy, right? So even like the Kashmiri leadership at the time knew that sort of a full incorporation of a Muslim majority region into India would be problematic and would be met with resistance. And that is why they agreed on something called Article 370, which was a special article in the Indian constitution that gave Kashmir its autonomous status. It meant that Kashmir would have its own flag, its own constitution, its own legislative assembly, even its own prime minister. I mean, the only thing that India was supposed to kind of have control over was its foreign affairs, defense, and communications. Mm. And yet that article was, eroded over time. Mm. But that was supposed to be the link between the relationship legally between India and Kashmir.
Mm. So then in the present, when we think about Article 370 and its revocation, what does this now mean for Kashmiris?
Yeah, so, you know, on paper, the article has been eroded in many ways over time. The Supreme Court has come into Kashmir, the Indian Supreme Court, financial and other kind of institutions have also been there. So, you know, India's rule in Kashmir has gone beyond defense and communications for sure. Mm-hmm. But what the article allowed to do was to protect something that's kind of linked to the article was 35A, which gave, as you mentioned, the Kashmiri Legislative Assembly the right to dictate who was a permanent resident of the state. Mm. And permanent residents, because the state at that time was very concerned about maintaining Kashmir's demography as a Muslim majority region. So non-Kashmiris, Indians from different states, were not able to buy land or property or have government jobs or, be like, have the full rights of citizenship as Kashmiri permanent residents did. And now that safeguard is removed. And this is something that, you know, previous Indian governments, Congress, you know, the so-called more secular parties, although Kashmiris don't see them as secular or democratic, they knew that they had to hold on to Article 370 to at least give Kashmiris this veneer of autonomy. But the BJP and the Hindu nationalist government that's in power has a completely different understanding of Kashmir, in the sense that for them, well, it's actually, I wouldn't say it's completely different, but for both, they have claims over Kashmir, the territory, the place, but the reason is different. So for the BJP, it's part of this idea of a Hindu homeland, or the Akhund Bharat. So Kashmir, the way that it's situated geographically, if you look at kind of the maps of the Hindu nationalist territorial imagination, which has a goddess that's superimposed on the, you know, on the map of the Indian subcontinent, the goddess's head is on Kashmir. And so to not have Kashmir be a part of India would mean that the goddess's head would be, you know, would be cut off. So, and, you know, it's four decades, Hindu nationalist parties have been demanding that the Article 370 go away so that India can fully integrate Kashmir and settle it with Hindus, right, as with any other Indian state, and kind of erode its Muslim character.
Mm. So actually, speaking of also Article 35A, you know, with it comes these domicile certificates. Can you explain what that is, and then what the political, economic, and demographic implications will be, as, you know, people are being let in, or there are talks about, you know, the construction of Hindu-only settlements and so on and so forth?
Yeah, so what is really sinister about the plan is what the Indian state could have done is just, you know, revoked residency rights and allowed all Indians to come into Kashmir, you know, because Article 370 is gone, Article 35A is gone. But what I think it did not want to do, and especially given how it's treating its own Muslim minorities, it didn't want that those Indians who would now go to Kashmir would be Indian Muslims. So it, in my understanding, they created these domicile certificates, which would create a category of Indians that could permanently settle and have residency rights in Kashmir. And so there's like four or five categories. For example, people who've already worked in Kashmir or lived in Kashmir for 15 years, people who worked in the central government for 10 years and have, or their children, even though the children may have never been to Kashmir or lived there, they're still eligible. Refugees from West Pakistan are eligible, and a few other categories. And most of those categories are non-Muslims, right? So this is kind of why it was important for them to introduce the domicile certificates. And now what happens is that indigenous Kashmiris who've lived in Kashmir their whole life, their permanent residency status or their certificates don't count anymore. They have to now also apply for domicile certificates in order to gain employment or to be able to buy land and property and so on. So you're creating a situation where politically you change the demographics, right? Because now a whole host of Indians are already or will be eligible to settle in Kashmir. And they'll change the, you know, just the percentage of non-Muslims that are there. And they'll be able to vote in elections as well. And so they'll also try to bring in more right-wing parties to power. And economically, what you're doing is creating a situation where, as you already mentioned, there was a $5.3 billion loss. And people are really struggling economically, especially because of the communication restrictions and so on. So they're trying to bring in Indian businesses and kind of promote this idea of development, that Kashmir is a land of opportunity, which again is a very colonial construct, whether it's, you know, through Kashmir's tourism opportunities or IT, I think is another sector that they want to develop, agriculture, horticulture, and so on. But now Indians could be working in those industries, right? Because they can now move there and work there. So the issue is that Kashmiris themselves, indigenous Kashmiris, will be dispossessed from even their economic rights. And unemployment is already, I believe, around 20%, that's going to increase. So indigenous Kashmiris will have to find other outlets. They might be forced to leave right? Because economically, they won't be able to survive there.
Mm.
So, and environmentally, what's also scary is that many of these businesses that are being brought in, already mining businesses, Indian mining companies have started to operate in Kashmir and conduct mining operations. And so they are not restricted by any kind of environmental safeguards. They've kind of completely overlooked them.
Mm.
And so there's also dangers. You know, this is a fragile space ecologically as well. So there's dangers that environmentally things will also change, and you know, there'll be issues related to the to climate change. So on kind of all fronts, really, and culturally, I mean, there's just so much to say. They're planning on introducing Hindi as the official language, and also, you know, changing textbooks, changing kind of any understanding or notions of like a Kashmiri nationhood or identity as well, and kind of completely subsuming it under this kind of Hindu nationalist, historical, revisionist account.
Mm. I mean, this is, you know, as a scholar that works on the, you know, question of Palestine, this is, it feels like either it's, you know, it's just another page of the Israeli the Zionist playbook, or it's their own playbook, but very, very carefully also studied in relation to other, you know, projects, you know, projects that try to erase a demographic or a people, you know, and in many ways is incredibly genocidal. So it's resonating in terms of also, as I'm thinking about other geographies, that this seems similar in, albeit distinct, right, because of its own national history. But, you know, as the siege has happened, this communication lockdown is happening, and there's more troops that have been brought in an already highly militarized, or the highest militarized zone in the world. What is life on the ground looking like from either your accounts of communication with family members or people there, or news accounts that you're reading? What has been the material conditions on the ground for people going through this really brutal siege at this moment and lockdown?
Yeah, I mean, it's been very difficult. And I'll say that it's, you know, things have been really difficult on the ground for decades, ever since the armed rebellion began, and in the intensive militarization of Kashmiri society began in the late 80s.
Mm.
You know, there's been vast numbers of human rights abuses that Kashmiris have been subject to. But I think in the past year, what you really hear is that Kashmiris have just felt completely silenced, and literally silenced, in the sense that they, you know, for months there was absolutely no communication coming out. and they had not only restricted the internet, which they do fairly often, but they'd also cut down the landlines as well. So they really did not want any news to come out of Kashmir,
right,
which is what's frightening. And so in that time, you know, thousands of people have been detained. They have really escalated military campaigns against the rebel fighters. They have gone into different neighborhoods and areas and conducted cordon and search operations, harassed people, tortured people, and really intimidated kind of every possible pocket of resistance. Social media is something that, you know, is, you know, already Kashmiris are not allowed to protest. Like, when you think about places, even in Palestine or Lebanon or so on, and you see people come to the streets, India has completely disallowed any public gathering, peaceful protests, and so on. What you mostly see is like young boys in neighborhoods who, you know, similar to other places, are throwing rocks at the Indian army.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes during funerals of civilians that were killed or rebels that were killed, you'll see people gathering and chanting slogans. But there's no allowance of any kind of political protest in the sense that we are used to. And so, you know, many Kashmiris took their resistance online, but even that now is being heavily, heavily surveilled.
Mm.
Just recently, there were 300 Twitter accounts that were named as being, you know, too politically conscious. And so I've heard stories of people's family members being called into the police station and asked about their online activity. and journalists have been targeted and harassed. Photojournalists have been targeted and harassed. I mean, like, when I say that they're really trying to shut down, like, any sense of resistance, they're doing it totally. They're trying to have complete thought control in that sense. And so people obviously feel scared and like they don't know how they can protest, you know. Nonviolent resistance is criminalized. Violent resistance obviously is criminalized. So what do you do in that situation? And, you know, even for people who want to kind of think beyond the politics of it all, who just want to be able to live a daily normal life, they cannot. I have family members who are, you know, either trying to apply for jobs, they've completed medical school, or they are, you know, they just finished high school and they want to go for college or university. And A, like, for the longest time, it was so hard for them to even apply because of the internet restrictions. But B, now where do they apply exactly? Like, they, many Kashmiris would go to different universities in India, but now they're also feeling insecure about being there because they're identified as Kashmiris and thus harassed as well. And so, you know, now the educational institutions in Kashmir will be open up to outsiders. So the competition to get entry there will be high as well. So you're just leaving a people with really no options for any kind of life with dignity. And I think that that is what is just so sinister about this, this whole process.
Well, you know, also, I mean, I'm thinking about, you know, something that Goldie Ashuri, Kashmiri study scholar, has sort of, and I think other scholars have talked about, but I'm specifically quoting Goldie here, saying the first phase of this occupation was the contested accession to India. The second phase was the immense militarization of the region and bringing in laws that give the Indian Army complete impunity for their actions in Kashmir. And then the third phase will be marked by a full-on settler colonial project. What you're describing and some of the moves that, you know, I mean, there are elements, of course, of colonial domination already at play. But I'm just wondering how the recent changes you've discussed with the abrogation of Articles 370 and 35A demonstrate how it's becoming a settler colonial project.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, one kind of primary way is just through the influx of Indian settlers that can now enter Kashmir, live there. But also, there have been comments made by leading Indian officials, including the Indian Consul General in New York City last year, where he was speaking to a private gathering. And he said something like, you know, I don't know why we're so worried. India has a model, the Israeli model. And so, you know, what he was basically referring to was settlements. So already they've started developing housing colonies or issuing out like an order to develop, I believe, 200,000 housing units. And who's going to be housed in those units? And they're calling it housing units, right? No, but these are settlements. They'll bring in, you know, either the people who now can obtain domicile or Indian get like workers, migrant workers who have also been in Kashmir for quite some time, and they're bringing in more and more kind of every day. Like, people who've been flying in and out of Kashmir have been telling me that the planes are just full of migrant workers. And the issue there also becomes that, you know, for Kashmiris are not xenophobic, right? It's not that, like, but now they're going to create a situation in which, you know, they might be pushing back against these migrant workers being there and taking over their, you know, being participating in the settler colonial process. But India can just push back and then say, well, these guys are just being xenophobic, like they're racist, you know. So it's really sinister how they're kind of thinking through all of these different angles. So there's the construction of the settlements, and of course settlements, as in other places where those have existed, will be buttressed by further militarization, checkpoints, some kind of system of apartheid where, you know, transportation and resources are redirected towards those settlements and away from the indigenous population. I believe they're trying very hard to create divides in Kashmiri society, and they have done this as part of their colonial rule for 70 years, but you know, divides between Kashmiri Hindus, for example, Pandits, and Kashmiri Muslims, Kashmiri Sikhs and Kashmiri Muslims, Kashmiri Buddhists and Kashmiri Muslims in particular, and Shia Muslims and, you know, Sunni Muslims, different ethnic groups as well. You know, all of these groups will ultimately lose out as a result of the settler colonial project, but then they'll create a way in which certain groups could potentially get some benefits and, you know, serve this project, and then increasingly create those divides in society as well. So yeah, and of course the capitalist angle to this is really sinister. There's a number of Indian companies like Ambani's,
Reliance
and so on, who already have their eyes set on this quote unquote land of opportunity. And, you know, they've already had a number of road shows in India and elsewhere. And one more recently, that was a webinar where they're kind of projecting this as an investment opportunity and trying to get in investors as well. Mm. You know, it's like almost, it's eerie how every step of the way they're thinking through this project. Another thing that I forgot to mention earlier is that one of the top army men, his name is Bipin Rawat. Last year, he'd mentioned that, you know, we need to have like some kind of de-radicalization camps for these young Kashmiri youth or young people, you know, children essentially who are quote unquote becoming radicalized. So, you know, one also worries that they'll have some kind of, you know, East Turkestan situation as well with what's happening with the Uyghurs. And as you mentioned earlier, like there are such stark parallels. All these countries learn from each other. They work together. India and, of course, are very close. India and China are ironically not in the best of terms. And more recently there were skirmishes, but even then, like both are extremely repressive towards these populations.
Yeah, I mean, this just makes me think and reflect more also about the rise of fascist regimes globally and what it means for various populations that have already been undergoing state violence, how these kinds of fascist draconian policies will be further intensified through xenophobia, racism, and specifically Islamophobia, as well as the forcible suppression of oppositional politics. And I just think about what this means for people that resist, you know, because it's just really, really frightening at the level of the way clampdown will happen. I'm also just thinking back to December before the pandemic, when the highly contentious Citizenship Amendment Act and the implementation of the National Registry of Citizens in India led to mass protests against these anti-Muslim and xenophobic policies of this Hindutva right-wing regime whose nationalist ideology is, you know, trying to divide and separate people that have been coexisting together for centuries because of their idea of producing some sort of ethno-national Hindu Rashtra, you know. And that is really frightening, especially for those that resist these policies, be it leftist, progressives, Muslims, whether that be within the state or outside the state. And, you know, what does this mean for those that do not identify with this authoritarianism? And what are the ramifications this will have for resistance and mass mobilizations? As we know, this will be met and is being met with really harsh policing and militarized violence. And I just want to sort of highlight those thoughts that, you know, have kind of been provoked as you were speaking. Moving to a different direction,
as we have some context here, because one of the things that, my own sort of, I've been learning about this region for quite some time now, part of it because, you know, my own partial history is connected to this geography of South Asia and or the subcontinent. And when I was growing up sort of reading or learning about this, in academic and public discourses on Kashmir, often Kashmiri perspectives have been silenced or not given space. And so when I sort of learned about, you know, the Critical Kashmir Studies Collective and their formation to intervene, to shift the analysis on the region, I was really excited by this and actually started to read and really look at the work of all of you as a kind of different narrative, And to also have a different mode of analysis of this, not just as an educator, but also as a political activist that, you know, organizes in movements. And so I'm just wondering if you can speak a little bit to the Critical Kashmir Studies Collective and perhaps discuss the pedagogical impetus of why this collective was formed and what was sort of the pedagogical, you know, what were some of the insights as you were developing this collective or you know, forming this group of people and assembling each other, but also the kinds of insights you had on a different kind of analysis of Kashmir?
Yeah, I mean, I think you you really accurately described like what scholarship on Kashmir was like, you know, and has been like really since 1947, where it's only kind of either foregrounding the Indian nationalist or the Pakistani nationalist accounts. And in the American Academy, it's really frankly been the Indian nationalist accounts, just given the kind of overarching influence of some of the upper caste Indian scholars that we are all familiar with. Mm. And it's also like, it's also was a field that was dominated by political scientists and IR types and, you know, looking at Kashmir strictly through the prism of geopolitics, terrorism, security, and so on. And even for those who are historians, like there was no understanding of Kashmir as a place that was, that had its like own unique history and context that was separate from the Indian nation state. Mm. The issues in Kashmir, the armed rebellion and so on, the resistance was just described as, you know, problems or challenges within India's federalism. Mm. And what can India do to like, just, you know, manage Kashmir better and things like that. So all of them obviously were completely very inaccurate depictions of what was happening and what, you know, Kashmiris themselves were living and saying. And so about, I would say, a decade ago, a group of like feminist scholars, mm. Some who are Kashmiri, or most who are Kashmiri by identity, both Muslim and Pandit, and others kind of have been in conversations about what does it mean to do critical Kashmir studies. And so the collective was formed. Initially, they held a series of like pre-conferences or conferences or panels during like different South Asia conferences, the AAAs, there's a couple of anthropologists as well, mm. Just to bring different groups of people together, but also those who don't necessarily work on Kashmir, but work on the region broadly and are interested in like rethinking either India or Pakistan through the lens of Kashmir. And so they've, you know, done a great job of kind of putting together both these conferences, but also different edited volumes and, of course, their own scholarship as well. And so, the idea is really to kind of center and foreground Kashmiri voices and aspirations, and not really just, you know, the most dominant ones, but also look into the different regions and what the situation is like, for example, in Jammu or Ladakh or in Azad Kashmir, the part of Kashmir that's, you know, under Pakistani administration. So to really kind of think through all of this, but in many ways, like be very forthright about describing India's colonial relationship to Kashmir, and being forthright about calling Kashmir an occupation. Mm-hmm. And now being very forthright about calling this a settler colonial project, because all of these words you will not see at all from this kind of earlier generation or group of scholars who, you know, for them, it was an ethno-nationalist movement or a separatist movement or a terrorist movement. So I think like one of the biggest impacts that I think it's had is like, you know, being very careful and cognizant about the kind of terminology that you use when you're talking about Kashmir. And from there, you can then begin to have a much deeper conversation about what then it looks like to live in the most militarized zone in the world, what it means to have you know, all of these different layers that I've kind of been describing about how Indian state control operates in Kashmir, what that looks like, but also what Kashmiri resistance looks like. So to also engage with, you know, the output that Kashmiris have given in terms of their, you know, creativity and other things and analysis. So So yeah, I think that's kind of the idea behind it.
And what has the response been?
You know, I think for the longest time, it was kind of given like a, it was ignored, maybe I would say, like not a lot of, you know, and especially like South Asian studies, it's an extremely problematic field, just given the kind of people that populate it. And I would say, you know, I always like in a weird way envy Middle East studies, although I'm sure it has its own complications. But there is really like a decolonial lens in that mm-hmm. field. Mm-hmm. And I think the exciting work that's come out on Palestine and other places has transformed the field in general to just be so much more abreast of like theoretical developments. Mm. And that kind of analysis, I think, is really only just starting now with a newer group of scholars who aren't necessarily like beholden to their nationalist, you know, whatever impulses as they may be. Mm. So I think amongst a younger group of scholars, there is a lot of energy and excitement around it. Mm. But I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't necessarily say that we've been able to like transform the field or anything like that. I think it's the possibility for sure exists. Mm. And I think we can think through some of what that would entail or look like. But you know, everything starts as a beginning and then it keeps going on.
Great. Well, I mean, it's also really exciting to know, because I mean, I think this is also part of my, not that Middle Eastern studies is not, you know, it doesn't have its problems, mm-hmm. but I think this was also one of my, you know, sort of why it was where I went, you know. Mm-hmm. Also, this collective has also been part of developing the Kashmir syllabus. Can you speak to the pedagogical significance of the syllabus and why teaching it might be important?
Yeah. So, one of the things that we wanted to be able to do is just, you know, we always get asked like, okay, where can I turn when I want to learn more about Kashmir? And there's always been like a few classics that you always can recommend people. Mm. But I think we kind of really need to get to the level of understanding, you know, the multiple ways in which all of this has played out. So from, of course, history, but also from like an anthropological, literary, film studies perspective, thinking through issues of environment, political economy, and so on. So our idea behind the syllabus was to, you know, like this body of work that we could identify as being part of this field of critical Kashmir studies, challenging Indian nationalist or other nationalist frameworks, providing some kind of decolonial lens, what it exists. And it was so great to see that there was actually so much that had been published, not just in terms of books or edited volumes, but even just some really compelling articles. And so, you know, we kind of wanted to celebrate the field thus far, but also give people an opportunity to, you know, whatever their interests might be, that, you know, if you're not working on South Asian studies, but say, for example, you are working on empire and, you know, some aspect of empire, that you can actually look through the syllabus and see like, actually this, I might want to incorporate this article on Kashmir in my class. So I hope that people would be able to use it for something like that. But in addition to that, what we wanted to also add was just some of the amazing literature, like novels and poetry and, you know, memoir type of writings and films that have been coming out from Kashmir as well. Just because that kind of firsthand account is really important, photography and so on. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the idea behind the syllabus.
That's great. So also you have conducted teach-ins on the occupation of Kashmir. Can you describe your pedagogical approaches when you're doing these teach-ins? Like how might you design them? And what might be what you're hoping people walk away with?
Yes. So the design is still kind of in flux. I change it based on kind of the audience and what their level of familiarity with the issue would be. But mostly I think we kind of start with the basic history, like I did with you earlier. And also putting this history in a much longer durée of not just, you know, that this whole issue didn't simply start in the 1980s or in even in 1947. Mm-hmm. Like, Kashmiris have kind of always been demanding their political and economic rights and freedom, you know, this phrase freedom. They've been demanding that for centuries, really. Mm. So kind of giving that much longer durée of Kashmiri history, situating it, of course, then in what happened in 1947, talking a bit about how the things that, you know, existed between partition and the rise of the armed rebellion and the mass movement in the late 1980s, and then spending a lot of time on just talking about what the period of the 90s was like for Kashmiris, just because, you know, that's what we have all kind of grown up with and what we know in terms of the massive human rights abuses and all of the things that were happening, that many of us actually either lived through or experienced and so on. And making that a little bit more personal as well, because I think it is important, if not using your own like personal accounts, but maybe reading from reading from like narratives of people whose family members have been disappeared, things like that. And then really ending with what happened on August 5th, why it was significant, and kind of presenting this idea of the settler colonial project, what it already looks like. And, you know, up until March, we all kind of knew that this was happening, but it was really when that domicile law was incorporated at the end of March that it became so much more tangible. So I think now, the teaching will look a little bit different. I think you almost have to start with the settler colonial project and then kind of go from there and maybe bring in the history. But I do think it is important now to kind of alert people to the absolute urgency of the moment that we're in and what is being planned. And then perhaps draw that broader history or stroke. So I think we're still kind of thinking through the teach-ins because, yeah, things are changing fast.
I mean, it's always evolving, right, as new things happen and new perspectives get brought to light. But I also wanted to now move to kind of speaking about liberation. And before getting your own perspective, in the 80s, the Kashmiris had established a liberation front in Jammu and Kashmir. Can you explain what brought rise to the front and then what this front politically seeked and then what happened to the front? Is it still around today or has that been completely, liquidated? Like, what is the status of that resistance today?
Yeah, so in terms of resistance in Kashmir, it kind of has like a two parallel, sometimes at each other's throats kinds of histories where you have, since even before partition and of course after, a group of people who have always wanted merger with Pakistan, for example. And some of them are, of course, affiliated with religious groups like the Jamaat-e-Islam, but others aren't. Some just, feel that it made sense at the time of partition for this Muslim majority region to be incorporated into Pakistan. And then at the same time, you also have had this kind of Kashmiri nationalist sentiment, which has ebbed and flowed in different ways over the course of the, past century. Initially it sought like better economic rights. It was very like sort of leftist and socialist in orientation. Believed in this idea of Kashmiri nationalism, that Kashmir is, this place, it has this territorial imagination and so on. Unfortunately, elements of that nationalist movement got appropriated by the Indian state. So many of them were part of what became later client regimes after 1947. But there were still elements of that nationalist movement that were still demanding a plebiscite. And interestingly enough, this idea, like kind of more formally, this idea of Kashmiri independence began in the Pakistan side of Kashmir, so in Azad Kashmir. And that is where initially the National Liberation Front and then finally the Jammu Kashmir Liberation Front started in Azad Kashmir was really active, especially in the UK diaspora, because a lot of people from Azad Kashmir also went to the UK. And then in the 70s and 80s, also started to gain footing in occupied Kashmir. Mm-hmm. And one kind of famous person that you might have heard about is Maqbool Bhutto, who was killed by the Indian state in 1984. Mm-hmm. And so the JKLF basically was an indigenous group. They had kind of an understanding of a secular, and when I say secular, I don't mean that they were like opposed to an Islamic identity, but rather that they were inclusive in terms of how they imagined Kashmir's future. Nationalist ideology, I guess, modeled in many ways perhaps with the PLO and other liberation movements. At the time. And Algerian movements and so on. So they, you know, initially started a series of attacks against Indian state targets in Kashmir, and then that's when the massive militarization began, and they did not have the kinds of resources to be able to take this on by themselves. So many of them went across the border to Pakistan, got trained, and then came back and fought. And at the same time, Pakistan also sent its own militant group that supported merger with Pakistan called the Hizbul Mujahideen, which is still in operation today. And the leaders of the JKLF, you know, because Pakistan then kind of started to support its own group more, there was some infighting between the two groups. And the JKLF and the Indian state, of course, also played the two groups against each other. And so the JKLF was kind of cornered into a position where they were made a deal, like a peace deal with the Indian state, that they would give up their arms and kind of join the more, not the peaceful process. And so that's, you know, that's kind of what happened. And their leaders have been arrested. You know, their main leader right now, Yasin Malik, is in jail. He's been in jail for some time. But really, whether it's the JKLF, whether it's the Hurriyat, the All Parties Hurriyat Conference, which was a conglomeration of different pro-independence and pro-Pakistani groups. India has constantly paid different leaders and personalities against each other. And of course, there's been infighting amongst their ranks as well. And now most of them are under arrest or under house arrest. So they've been completely, you know, neutralized in that sense.
Well, as we speak on this topic, I'm just wondering what Kashmiri self-determination and Azadi freedom mean for you, as that has been the heart of your work and the heart of your struggle. I wonder for you how you imagine this and what that might look like.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, and this might be particular to my identity because I am in the diaspora, I see it as kind of like a global internationalist struggle, you know, where it's linked to all of us, really. I mean, the kind of struggles that we are all involved in against imperialism, colonialism, capitalism, and a whole host of other isms that have kept us down. So, of course, you know, and I'm also someone who's not like particularly attached to the idea of the nation state. I think we have to like think beyond the nation state and what that means. So, yes, I mean, self-determination is a valuable goal in the sense that Kashmiris themselves should be able to decide what, you know, what kind of future, what kind of sovereignty they want to be able to have or be. But I guess for us, it's also just a much longer process of thinking through politics and geopolitics a bit more, and like, you know, what can emancipated liberations look like? I mean, if we're just kind of getting into a situation where we have, where we bring in an elite class that's going to continue to doing the same kinds of things that India's been doing, then, you know, that's not exactly freedom. So yeah, I mean, it's just that basic dignity, I guess, of dignity of life, work, and being able to live in security and not having to worry about the kinds of things that Kashmiris have been worrying about for all these decades. That's what's really important, I think, and at stake.
Well, I hope it happens in our lifetime. and finally, because, you know, you talked about the urgency of the struggle, I'm also just wondering what you think are some important forms or expressions of solidarity, specifically from leftists, progressive groups or movements that might be very important or useful for the Kashmiri struggle in this particular historical moment. And also solidarity that comes from, you know, folks that are living specifically in the US and Canada, since you are located in the diaspora.
Yeah, I mean, I think one kind of thing to answer with this question is I'm sensing a lot of like divisions amongst movements that are leftist and also those that might be more like, I guess, religiously inscribed or motivated. Mm. And I'm not, you know, I don't necessarily completely identify as a leftist. I feel kind of more broadly as part of something called the Muslim left, where religion is not taken as something that's an opiate of the masses, which I think often happens in leftist discourses and movements. And so that solidarity is always conditional upon, like, you know, these people reflecting the kinds of values or goals that we ourselves want. Mm. So I think for that solidarity to really be exhibited in a way that is meaningful, like, I think there has to be that space of allowing people's religious identities to be a part of this struggle or this moment. And so beyond that, though, and I think that's like really applicable for multiple struggles in perhaps including Palestine. Beyond that, I think, you know, of course, education is key to this. Like, I already can sense that so much has changed just because more and more people just right. know where Kashmir is. And once they hear about what's going on, they're completely shocked, because that's not the soft power image that India has of itself or that people have of India automatically. And then you just really have to get to a point where you're, you know, engaging in meaningful political action. If, for example, some Indian representative, state representative or academic is coming to your college or your city, holding protests, holding, you know, writing against that, just really raising awareness in every possible shape that you can that India's idea as this, as a secular democracy is being challenged. And part of this is also holding our institutions accountable for any kinds of relationships that they may have with India as well. And so, you know, something like a boycott movement with all of its limitations, I think, is also applicable. But yeah, I think all of these questions around solidarity, we're still really working towards to try to figure out what is going to be really meaningful in the long term.
Well, I just want to thank you for your critical analysis, your important insights today, and the fierce work that you have been doing for a very long time and continue to do to speak truth to power in this struggle for freedom. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Liberation Pedagogy Podcast. If you'd like to learn more and engage with us, please check us out at www.liberationpedagogyproject.com and follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook.